I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to The Connection. Change is inevitable in life. Very few things remain the same. We know this, and yet we generally resist change or react with anxiety or fear or grief when our plans, hopes, and dreams get upended. Certainty makes us feel safe or gives us the illusion of safety. Our brains tend to see the unexpected as a threat, and our bodies react accordingly. Our guest, cognitive psychologist Maya Shunker, has had a long-standing interest in understanding how people handle the vagaries of life. Her popular podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, features interviews with guests about how they manage their personal upheavals. Her best-selling book, The Other Side of Change, Who We Become When Life Makes Other Plans, continues in that same vein. She also writes about her own struggles with her best-laid plans to be a concert violinist and a mother. She joins us today on The Connection to talk about making the most out of what we least expect. She was a senior advisor at the Obama White House, appointed the first behavioral science advisor to the United Nations. And Maya Shunker, nice to have you with us today on The Connection.
Thanks so much for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. Let's begin with you and begin with the fact that when you were about 9 years old, you were a student at Juilliard. You had been accepted in their pre-college program. You had been playing for a couple of years. At one point, violinist Itzhak Perlman chose you to be a student of his. So you had a career plan, a life mapped out in front of you. What happened?
Yeah, I would say that my entire childhood was devoted to the violin. Everything centered around it. And I very quickly developed big dreams of becoming a professional violinist. With the endorsement of Perlman, a lot of my insecurities started to dissipate. And I thought, okay, he's giving me that vote of confidence that I need to really think I can make it. And everything was going according to plan until one summer, I was studying under Perlman at his summer music camp, and I overstretched my pinky finger playing a challenging piece by Paganini. And I heard a popping sound, and I could tell things were not great. And fast forward, doctors eventually told me that my dreams were over and that this was a career-ending injury.
You were 15 years old at the time, right? You were a teenager.
Yes, I was 15. Yes. And looking back, there was something very curious about my grief, Marty, which is that I found myself grieving not just the loss of the instrument, but also the loss of myself in this more fundamental way. Because all of my formative experiences as a kid had involved the violin in some way, I felt like there was no Maya without it. You know, to this day, my right shoulder is slightly elevated compared to my left because of all the hours I spent practicing. My body kind of grew around the instrument. And so that's when I realized, wow, this is a huge part of my self-identity. And in many ways, what I'm grieving is not just the loss of music, but the loss of myself.
Well, even to add to that, your grandmother was a classical violinist in India. In fact, it was her violin that was in the attic at your family's home.
Yeah, she had played just as a hobby as a little girl growing up in Burma and in India. And one day my mom went to the attic and brought down her dusty violin. And I think because I shared a very deep emotional connection with my grandmother, but we were separated by so many oceans, in many ways, the violin was a way for me to feel close to her, for me to feel connected to her. And so I very quickly asked my mom for a pint-sized violin of my own.
Were you depressed when you got this diagnosis and basically the message that you're not going to be a concert violinist? Did you get depressed?
Yeah, I was the recalcitrant teenager at first. I very much resisted the diagnosis. I kept playing with pain, performing until the pain became untenable. And I was forced to confront the facts of my situation. And then I was very much depressed and longing for something that filled me with the same sense of purpose and passion that music had. It's taken me a long time to extract a meaningful lesson from this experience, and I'm hoping I can share it with listeners today so that they don't make the same mistakes I made. But what I learned is that it can be quite precarious for us to anchor our identities too firmly in what it is that we do. And that's because life can take away that what instantly, in a moment. And then we are left unmoored and feeling like we don't have meaning and purpose in our lives. And so I've learned that it can actually be more stable and robust to anchor our self-identities to why we do the things we do, why we love the things we love. And when I asked myself what it was about classical music that really drew me in, it was a love of human connection. Hmm. I loved forging a deep emotional bond with either my fellow musicians or the people that I was performing in front of, and potentially making them feel something they'd never felt before. And importantly, just because I lost the ability to play the violin did not mean that I lost what led me to love it in the first place, right? That passion, that underlying motivation was still very much intact. And now the exercise could become, well, how can I find other ways of expressing that underlying drive now that I can no longer play music? And it turns out that I have sort of subconsciously been drawn to spaces that feed this deep need for human connection. Hosting my podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, writing my book, The Other Side of Change, these are all at their core about building that bond with other human beings. And so I would urge everyone who's listening to ask themselves, what is it that makes me love the things that I love? Right. Maybe it's a love of service. Maybe it's having a creative outlet. Maybe it's getting better at a skill. Whatever that why is, make part of your identity that. And that way, when life makes other plans, you have a compass, a North Star that can guide you towards your next steps.
Your father gave you some really important advice. In fact, really excellent advice. He said to you, you had been wearing blinders for the last decade. This is when you were on this track to be a concert violinist. Then he said, expose yourself to as many things as possible and keep an open mind. For a young person that had been so single-minded about, you know, what you wanted your life to be, was that scary? I mean, the thought of sort of opening up the world and seeing what was there, did that seem scary to you?
Yeah, you've said it beautifully. I mean, I was so single-mindedly focused on this pursuit that I failed to appreciate or even see the opportunities outside of the sphere of music. One thing that I loved about my dad's advice, and by the way, this was advice I was receiving the summer before college when all my plans were upended. I hoped to be a music performance major going into college, and now that's off the table and I need to find a new discipline. He said, try not to have a goal in mind as you're engaging in this exploratory space in time. Right. Because if you do that, you might prematurely foreclose on options that are actually quite exciting or interesting, right? If I went into that period of exploration thinking, okay, I need to figure out what my major is, well, I would have actually missed cognitive science altogether because I didn't even know that that was a field or a discipline that I could study. And so it was actually during that summer that I read a fascinating book about language development by Steven Pinker, and it really pulled the curtain back on the human mind and its extraordinary abilities. And I learned for the first time that something I had totally taken for granted at this point in my life, which is the ability to both acquire language and produce it in everyday life, was the result of really complex cognitive machinery that was operating behind the scenes. And I just remember, Marty, being filled with awe. Wow, if this is what is involved in generating language, what's involved in making complex decisions or falling in love or forecasting the future? It just cracked open my imagination about all the kinds of questions that one can study about the mind. And again, I'm so grateful for my dad's advice because I would never have known to read a book like that if my single goal was to figure out what I would study. And I credit that book with being the reason that I became a cognitive scientist in the first place.
But it's so interesting because you have focused so much of your podcast, also this book, about change, why we resist it, why it's so anxiety producing. So do you feel like you have mastered this part of your of your life and your psychology?
I think lots of authors would say they're doing me search
exactly
when they're writing their books. So I have always had profound anxiety when it comes to any kind of instability, uncertainty, ambiguity. I'm not alone. The human brain is not wired to enjoy uncertainty. One of my favorite research studies shows that we are actually more stressed when we're told we have a 50% chance of receiving an electric shock than when we're told we have a 100% chance of receiving that shock. So we would rather be certain a negative thing is going to happen than to have to grapple with any ambiguity or uncertainty. And it's such a funny quirk of the brain, but I think so many of us can resonate with this. I just want to know how the story ends, you know? Give me the shocks. Just don't put me in that torturous period of not knowing how things are going to end. And so in many ways, I was drawn to studying change because I think at the end of the day, it's really about control.
Mm.
Go ahead.
I was going to say it's control, but it's often the illusion of control. I mean, you have to live your life thinking, you know, you're going to get in your car, you're going to go to work, things are going to happen the way you planned. Be hard to live knowing that at any moment something terrible, horrible could happen. I mean, in some cases that does, but you can't live like that all the time.
It's a deeply psychologically adaptive trait that we have, that we do fall prey to the illusion of control in everyday life. Like you said, if we did not feel that we had control over the outcomes in our lives, most of us would descend into nihilism and wonder what this whole thing was about anyway, right? Why try hard? Why plan ahead if really, you know, one twist of fate can upend the whole system? And we do have control over a lot of things that happen in our lives. But of course, there are those moments out of the clear blue sky in which the anvil drops and we can find ourselves wildly unprepared for those moments. And so my goal actually in creating a slight change of plans and then in writing this book was to figure out, well, what do we do in those moments of upheaval? Not the changes that we will, that we pine for, that we work hard towards, but the ones that really just pull out the rug from underneath us and we're wondering how to climb out of the rubble still intact. And I think my biggest insight in all of this was, wow, this book, even though it's about change, is really about identity at its core. You know, we talked about the example of me as aspiring concert violinist as a kid and feeling like the reason why change was so scary was that it was a threat to my self-identity. I think for so many of us, right, we do anchor ourselves to the roles or labels we carry. And to our earlier discussion, that's also really adaptive. We have a lot to gain from identifying as an athlete or as a teacher or as a musician. It can breed a feeling of camaraderie with our fellow musicians or athletes or teachers. It can also give us a sense of meaning and purpose every day to carry those labels. The challenge, of course, though, is that those labels can be taken away.
Indeed.
And so
we're up on our break here, and that's Maya Shankar. And she is our guest today on The Connection. Wrote a book earlier this year titled The Other Side of Change, Who We Become When Life Makes Other Plans. And we talked very briefly about the fact that she was on track to be a concert violinist until she was injured. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. We have all made plans for the future when something suddenly, seemingly out of nowhere, alters our hopes and dreams and those big plans. How can we make the most out of what we least expected? And that's what we're talking about with our guest, Maya Shankar. And she has a new book called The Other Side of Change, Who We Become When Life Makes Other Plans. You say, and it's interesting because we live with ourselves, so we should know ourselves pretty well, but we know how denial works and all those kinds of things, but that we're not very good at predicting our response to a big change when it comes along. Perhaps not giving ourselves enough credit to be able to actually master, maybe even take on that big change. How can we sell ourselves short?
So we are notoriously bad affective forecasters, which means we're bad at predicting how we will feel about future events. And this is very well established in the research literature. One of the reasons why we make bad predictions is that we forget that we are constantly changing.
Right.
we fall prey to a cognitive bias called the end of history illusion, which basically says that while we fully acknowledge we've changed considerably in the past, we fail to appreciate that we will continue to change moving forward. So you show me a picture of high school Maya, and I'm like, oh my God, cringe. I'm like barely even the same person. But if you ask me, well, how much do you expect to change moving forward? I'd be like, eh, Marty. What you see is what you get. This is the finished product. So researchers have said we falsely believe that the present moment is a watershed moment in which we have become the person we will be for the rest of our lives. Now, there's some hope in this message for those who are navigating change. And that is, when we feel absolutely daunted at the outset of a change, like we can't possibly navigate what's up ahead, whether it's an illness or the loss of a relationship or a unnerving secret that you've learned about a family member, let's say, you have to remember that the change itself that you're enduring will change you in turn. You will emerge on the other side with new values, new perspectives, new beliefs about the world, new capabilities that can really empower you and enable you to engage with the change with much more equanimity potentially and to engage with it in a much more productive way than you think you might be able to. And I love this message because I have felt transformed by the changes in my life. I often say that when a big change happens to you, it also leads to lasting change within you. And the people that I interviewed for the podcast and the book together, by and large, they haven't been thrilled always that a negative change happened to them.
Sure.
Who would be if they're being honest, right? No one would will illness or loss into their lives. But they were deeply grateful for the person they became as a result of what they went through. They saw the world through new perspectives. They had a renewed sense of self-identity and relationship with self. They changed the way they saw their family's history. They had a different relationship with the future and uncertainty. And I find a lot of hope in those stories because, again, we can't change whether change happens to us, but it is possible for us to change our relationship with it and to see that there is some possibility sitting deep within that change.
Does it matter? I mean, whether the change is a good thing, like let's say a job promotion, or a bad thing that we lose our job? I mean, yes, on paper you would think, yeah, who wouldn't want a job promotion? But oftentimes people can feel very anxious about that. Can I fulfill these new demands? Am I going to be the person that was given this opportunity? It can tap into a lot of unconscious anxiety.
Yeah, not just anxiety, but we also falsely predict how we will respond to positive changes. We often think, okay, I'm going to be happy if I get promoted. Okay, I'll finally be happy if I find my romantic partner. You know, it's called like the happily ever after fallacy, where we believe there's this finish line. And as soon as we achieve this goal of ours, suddenly happiness will descend on us. But that same bias that we have in which we mispredict the future, I mean, that applies equally to good events. So I always tell people, approach even seemingly positive changes with a deep amount of humility, because you don't know actually how you will respond to that new environment. And we sometimes forget that good changes, they don't happen in a vacuum either. Let's say you get promoted. Now all your colleagues are different. The way people treat you is different. Your responsibilities are different, right? And so there could be a lot of negative elements as well. And you want to be prepared for those too.
You talk about the role of denial. And I think especially when bad things happen, you know, one of our responses is to either deny that it's happening, or we want to avoid the consequences or even avoid that it's happening in our life. But there's a place, as you write, for denial. In fact, you quote Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who said that denial is nature's way of letting in only as much as we can handle, which I like very much because I think denial sometimes is given a bad name.
Absolutely. You should think of denial as a psychological immune response. It's our minds protecting us from the entirety of what we're up against and allowing only as much as we can tolerate to trickle in at any given time. There's some really interesting studies showing that denial in the short term actually can be very advantageous. It can lead to better outcomes, more resilience, a greater sense of positivity. Now, denial in the longer term is problematic, and that's what that's what I address in my book. I try to give people strategies for breaking out of long-term denial, because then you've failed to confront the facts overall, and you can, not engage in activities or efforts that are actually really critical for healing. And so I like, though, the nuanced perspective on denial, which is that it's not all bad. And we should be more forgiving of denial within ourselves and within others in the short term. I think it's very easy to judge harshly, to judge people harshly. Oh, gosh, my sister's in denial, my friend's in denial. But give them a little bit of grace in the short term. It's just their way of protecting themselves.
How do you get beyond the wall of denial, though, that doesn't budge? I mean, how do you get to the other side of that?
Well, usually the facts will confront you directly, but passage of time helps, of course. And I think some degree of exposure therapy helps, right? Sitting with the facts and letting them marinate and allowing yourself to feel negative emotions. We have a huge allergy toward feeling anything negative, but we know that when we confront our negative emotions, they stop being the boogeyman, and they start becoming just a part of our daily existence in our lives. And I think that's really important, to sit in sadness, to sit in despair, to sit in frustration. That can really help us process the visceral feelings we're having and allow them to start to settle in.
Talk a bit about psychological distancing, because I think that's kind of related to this, that when we're really, confronting or dealing with some difficult feelings about a change that we're going through, or perhaps even something that we did, how do we create a sort of, almost like we're looking at ourselves as if in the third person, as if we're somebody else, and sort of understanding ourselves as if someone else is doing that understanding for us?
Yeah, a very common experience in the aftermath of a negative change is rumination.
Right.
And rumination, by definition, is unproductive. It's when we're turning over the same thoughts over and over and over again, or trying to solve a problem ad nauseum, but are not making any progress, despite the fact our brains can trick us into believing that we're making progress, right? That we're just on the cusp of some big insight or epiphany, but in actuality, we're running on a hamster wheel.
Right.
And so I talk about a number of strategies that we can use to break out of the cycle of rumination. One of them is just the overall concept of psychological distancing. You're just trying to breathe space between your current preoccupations and the feelings and emotions and negative thought cycles that you have in your brain. One of the ways to do this is to take that third person perspective. So let's say you've had a really negative encounter with a coworker, and you wake up at 3 a.m. and you're turning it over and over and over. You can imagine that you're a fly on the wall revisiting that encounter with the coworker, but trying to be that neutral arbiter, right? The person that's just in the room witnessing events. And you might see things from new perspectives, new vantage points. You might poke holes in the narrative that you've been constructing about how that event unfolded. And in seeing the situation from new angles, you actually think about it differently. You have a more productive, constructive response. Another technique that I leverage all the
Let me just jump in. It almost sounds like being a therapist to yourself. I mean, that's what a good therapist would do, which was give you another perspective, another way of thinking about your thinking.
Yes, that's beautifully said. It's like you're coaching a friend in many ways, right? You would show more compassion to a friend. You'd be more objective with a friend. A really good friend, you would not mind poking holes in their narrative and saying, hey, look, I know you're doubling down on the fact that you're to blame in the situation, or you are the victim in the situation, but I see a little bit more complexity here than you might be appreciating. Let's talk through the ways in which we might think about this differently. And it's funny, there's actually a really slight tweak in language you can use in the moment that can help you foster this distance if you are struggling to do so, which is referring to yourself in the third person. So rather than saying, oh my God, I need to get a grip, you might be like, Maya,
get a grip.
Yeah, get a grip. And just that slight tweak from first person to third person, studies show it's extremely effective at breeding psychological distance.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Maya Shankar, and she's a cognitive scientist, a cognitive psychologist, I should say, and the author of a book that came out earlier this year called The Other Side of Change, Who We Become When Life Makes Other Plans. I'll make a little shift here, because your book is about people seeing an opportunity and then building a change or a life around that opportunity. You interviewed Dwayne Betts, as I did a couple of years ago. He was, as a teenager, charged with a carjacking, with robbery, the use of a firearm. He was sentenced to 9 years in prison. It was an adult prison, I should add. He was in solitary where he discovered poetry. And I want to play just a little clip from my interview with him where he describes what that meant to him. Let's give it a listen.
I was in solitary confinement and the cells were parallel and you couldn't have books in a hole. But there was sort of like an underground network where men kept books and hid books and had a sort of underground library going on. And all you had to do was shout on the door, somebody send me a book. And the book would slide under your cell like magic. And nobody even told you the rules. You just knew. You got the book, you read it, and then you passed it to somebody else. But the black poets slipped under my cell. I have no clue who gave it to me. I never asked because you don't ask things like that.
Right.
And I read the book, and the poems changed my life, and it made me a poet.
And he is a poet. In fact, I interviewed him on his book of poetry called Felon. But here's such an interesting but very dramatic example, Maya, of how change can happen sort of out of nowhere. I mean, who would have thought that a book slipped under a door in a prison could change someone's life?
So one of the most interesting things I discovered in interviewing Dwayne was actually there's a very important precursor to that book sliding under his jail cell. It wasn't as random as you might think. He had an encounter with a fellow prisoner that led to the experience of what's called moral elevation. Moral elevation is that warm, fuzzy feeling we get in our chest when we witness someone else's extraordinary behaviors or actions. So that could be their kindness or courage or self-sacrifice or resilience or resolve or any other number of amazing character traits. And importantly, when we experience moral elevation, it doesn't just feel good. It doesn't just restore our faith in humanity. It actually rewires our brains in very helpful ways. It actually cracks open our own imagination about what we are capable of. So in the case of Reginald Dwayne Betts, he came to prison and he was convinced that he was destined to be a certain kind of person because he now carried the label of prisoner. So he worried, will I develop a gambling habit? Will I become addicted to something? Will I become violent? He was so fearful of who he might become now that he was behind bars. But in witnessing a fellow prisoner named Bilal act in ways that violated his stereotypes, his assumptions of what prisoners were like, Bilal was the kind of guy who cared for the younger prisoners. He wasn't ruthlessly self-interested. He taught those young men how to box and how to protect themselves from the threat of violence. He woke up a few hours early to do 250 push-ups before the guards even came over. He had his uniform in prison crisply ironed every single day. He carried himself, as Dwayne said, like a man in uniform. And he showed Dwayne what it meant to be a beautiful human. What it meant to be lovely, I think, is what Dwayne, are the words that Dwayne used. And so it was in witnessing Bilal's example that Dwayne, for the first time, realized, wow, maybe I'm not destined to be a certain kind of person just because I wear the prisoner label. Or for other people, that might mean maybe I'm not destined to have a certain future because I'm now a full-time caregiver, or I now suffer from a chronic illness, or I'm no longer in this relationship. Maybe there are other possible futures open to me. And it was with that empowered mindset that when that book slid under his door and he read this poem, he thought, well, you know, I can't do for the young men what Bilal's doing for them. I'm not strong. I don't know how to teach them to box. But I can dignify their experiences through the written word. That I know how to do.
And again, he has become a poet. He's a lawyer as well and has moved on with his life. I would say, and I don't know him besides having just spent an hour with him interviewing, but he seemed like he was open to seeing Bilal and seeing Bilal's kindness. And there was something about the openness in him that allowed him to sort of incorporate this, what poetry could do to his life.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I read a lot about Dwayne and I listened to so many interviews, but I didn't know about Bilal or the role he played until Dwayne and I started digging deep. And Dwayne told me afterwards, he just started weeping after one of our conversations because he hadn't really reflected on that entire the entirety of that experience, you know, and what Bilal had meant for him. And he pulled out old letters with Bilal's amazing penmanship and was sharing them with me. And it was such a beautiful experience. I mean, for authors, right, we obviously care about what ends up in the book, but there's a whole behind the scenes experience that you share, an intimate relationship you build with the people that you interview. And it was just a wonder to behold, to witness Dwayne confront some of his demons. He used to joke, Maya, you got to pay my therapy bills because I'm in therapy for the first time now. But we built a beautiful friendship, you know, and I continue just to marvel at his growth and his ability to confront hard parts of his past and to grow from them.
We're almost up on our second break here, but it's also, I think, what mentors do. I mean, in part, mentors show us the way, maybe see things in us that we don't see in ourselves. And that then opens the door to maybe becoming that other person.
Yeah. And I think a helpful question you can ask yourself is when you have that change of plans, you can ask, who else can this person be? This person who I am. Yes, I might not be able to do X or Y anymore, but I still have all the experiences I've had, all the skills I've built, all the talents I innately possess. And let me ask, who else can this person become, armed with all of those capabilities?
And we have so many identities. I mean, we use different identities with different people.
Absolutely. Yeah. Identity is obviously not, you know, this one, you know, singular concept. Yeah, it's multifold, and the identities we express in different settings can even change day to day.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Again, Maya Shankar is our guest today on The Connection, and she is a cognitive psychologist. She's also an author, and her book is called The Other Side of Change, Who We Become When Life Makes Other Plans. She tells in her book about her coming to terms with the fact that she and her husband were not going to be able to have a baby of their own. And we'll talk about that after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe. If you're just joining us, Maya Shankar is our guest. We've been talking about her new book, The Other Side of Change. We talked about the fact that we're not very good at predicting how we will respond to big changes in our lives. Also, that there is a place for denial and avoidance when feeling overwhelmed. Well, you do describe in this book, Maya, the fact that you, ever since you were a little girl, wanted to be a mom. This was, you come from a big family, and it was just sort of expected, and perhaps just your plan for the future is that you would have a baby yourself. It didn't work out that way. As it turned out, you were unable to get pregnant, and you used a surrogate in order to have a child. Both times the surrogate lost the baby, which of course is so sad and so tragic when that happens. How did you deal with that?
It's hard to understate just how much children were part of my imagined future. I really felt like at times when I visualized not having a family, all the color drained from my life. At the same time, as I write in the last chapter of the book, which, by the way, was so unexpected, I wasn't anticipating for there to be any personal narratives. But what happened, interestingly, Marty, is as I was writing this book about everyone else's massive changes, I was undergoing this difficult change in my personal life, which was not succeeding at building a family with my husband. And I felt like, well, I have to kind of show my hand and be honest about my own struggles and try to extract any wisdom I can from the people that I've been interviewing to see if those insights are helpful. And so, I also experienced profound anxiety around having children, which I talk about. You know, we spoke earlier in this conversation about rumination.
Right.
I was seized by rumination when I was in college, when I started to spiral about all the ways in which my future children might suffer in this world, in ways that I wouldn't be able to protect them. And that was another, you know, huge source of anxiety for me is, you know, the world can be a difficult world to enter. And so how is going to square this with my deep desire to have kids? So anyway, needless to say, my relationship with motherhood was very fraught and complicated. And then we ended up trying to have kids. You know, my husband helped me overcome some of these anxieties, and then we weren't successful, right? There were multiple miscarriages. And so one thing that was really interesting is I still remember on the night of the second miscarriage, when we found out that we had lost identical twin girls, I was just despondent. And I remember being in our bedroom and the covers over me, and my husband, Jimmy, walks in and he says to me, "Maya, let's name a couple of things that we're really grateful for." And I was like, "Bro, no." I am so upset right now. We had had a roller coaster of a day where we had seen healthy beating hearts just hours earlier and then found out the devastating news of the miscarriage. And so I was in no mood to be grateful about anything. But as I looked at him and in the earnestness in his face, I finally succumbed and I generated a quick list. I said, first of all, Jimmy, you're at the top of my list. I'm so grateful for you. You know, to have found the love of my life is an extraordinary gift. And I'm grateful that this has made us stronger as a couple. And then, you know, it was curious. I found this list kind of flowing out of me. Like, I'm grateful to be an aunt to my six nieces and nephews. I'm grateful that I get to go into the closet in our apartment and host a slight change of plans and have these incredible conversations with people all over the world. I'm grateful for my workouts with my personal trainer, in which I get to gossip about reality TV with. I'm grateful for the strong rays of the California sun and my walks every day. And it was incredible to me what happened in that moment. It felt like magic. I had been so single-mindedly focused on this goal of becoming a parent that I had lost sight of how otherwise rich and multidimensional my life was, on all the other identities that I carried that brought me deep meaning and purpose. And this is very common, right? For those of us who are goal-oriented and want to achieve our dreams, we can lose sight of that. And what my husband unknowingly engaged me in is what psychologists refer to as a self-affirmation exercise. Mm-hmm. This is when we just write down all of the identities that we value, that bring us meaning and joy in our lives, but that critically are not threatened by the change we're going through. So if you're in a tough spot at work, you might focus instead on your rich spiritual life. If you are having a rough time in your relationship, you might focus on the community that you're building with your pickleball friends. You know, it's all about just reshifting the lens towards the things that are still intact, that have been preserved in spite of the change you're going through. And so would I say that I went to bed happy that night? Of course not. But did I go to bed feeling like more of Maya was intact? That I was still this whole entity who could still build a rich and meaningful life? Absolutely. And
you had a relationship with the woman who was the surrogate. I mean, it sounded like you had a very close bond with her.
Yeah, she's a lifelong part of my family, Haley. An extraordinary person in the years we spent, you know, trying to achieve this goal together. We built an incredible intimacy, and I was so moved by the kind of person that she was. And so there were multiple layers of heartbreak involved in this experience. You know, I was so pained by the idea that she was suffering, that she was going through the physical consequences of this miscarriage and multiple times over, you know? And so, it was a gut-wrenching loss for all of us.
So do you feel like you have fashioned a different kind of identity than the one that you had fantasized as a little girl growing up? Now that you don't have a child, I mean, you have each other, you have your husband, you have your job, you have your friends, your life. But have you been able to shape a new and different identity for yourself?
Yes. And I never thought that was possible, which I think speaks to the fact that we do change as a result of what happens to us. And we don't always appreciate the ways in which those changes might unfold. I quote in the book the definition of apocalypse, because it can often feel like we're undergoing a personal apocalypse when something tragic happens in our lives. And What's so interesting about the etymology of apocalypse is that it comes from the Greek word apokalypsis, which actually means revelation.
Yeah.
And that is very instructive because what it says is, yes, change can upend us, but it can also reveal things to us. We talked earlier, Marty, about how we don't always have a great command of who we are. You know, it's not like every day we're sitting there thinking, why do I believe all the things that I believe? Or what belief should I revisit today? We're busy. And most of the beliefs we carry were not the result of deliberate rational thought. They're the result of shortcuts and heuristics or messages that were passed down to us by our parents or through pop culture or through TV or other norms. And so that is to say, they're on flimsy ground and they're worth interrogating. For me, the revelation I had in part through this whole experience of loss was, why is it that I have anchored so much of my self-worth to motherhood? Why is it that I grew up believing that unless a woman has children, their life is not full? And in recognizing that this was a belief that I had, I was able to challenge it and to poke at it and to start building from scratch a new and far more robust identity. And so I can say that, you know, now, looking back, if you had asked me on the night of the miscarriage, will anything positive come from this? Will you ever feel comfortable not having children? I would have been absolutely certain that the answer was no. And yet here I am several years later, living the happiest, freest, most peaceful life that I could have imagined for myself. And that was wildly unexpected. I think in part, I should absolutely credit the people that I interviewed for the book because I think their wisdom was, you know, starting to percolate and lead to different thoughts and ideas. And I would just never have expected that I could build this child-free life and find so much richness in it.
You write about something, talk about a belief system, the sort of just world view that I think many of us believe that people essentially get what they deserve. In a just world, the bad people get the bad things that happen to them. The good people get the good stuff. When you think about it, that sort of makes no sense. I mean, there's no one essentially in charge and keeping score for how we live our life. But I wonder how that affects how we think about good things and bad things and making change. And if something terrible happens to someone else, did they deserve it or did they not?
Yeah, it's a fantastic question. We each have a locus of control. Some of us lean more towards an external locus of control, which means that we basically think that the universe is sort of randomly dictating how things turn out. So it's very tempting to believe that the world is just, right? Good things happen to good people, bad things happen to bad people. There's a nice input-output model. And the problem, though, is that when we believe that we are in control of how things turn out and that our good actions will be rewarded, it's great when good things happen.
Sure.
We can take credit for them. But when bad things happen that are outside of our control, we can unfairly blame ourselves. And this is a story I talk about in the book. It's a woman named Marianne.
I was just thinking of her.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Who accidentally driving kills a young boy who's running towards the mailbox. She was not speeding. She was not reckless. She was not drinking. It was just an accident. And unfortunately, because she had a very strong, what psychologists call internal locus of control, where she felt that her actions dictated what would happen in her life, she started to believe that she had some dangerous essence within her, because how else could you explain what had happened? And it was so threatening for Marianne to challenge her belief in a just world that she would rather engage in all this magical thinking about her being an existentially flawed person than to just confront that sometimes bad things happen to good people. And so she ended up holding herself up, protecting the world from her dangerous essence by not engaging with anyone for decades and never sharing her story. It was only when she actually came forward and publicly shared, actually on an NPR segment, what had happened to her, that she started to heal for the first time. Mm-hmm. And that critically, she started to loosen her grip on her belief in a just world and to start to see, you know, maybe there was nothing about me that led this to happen. Maybe there were no lessons to be learned. Sometimes things just happen and there's no reason behind it. And I feel it viscerally. Even when I just say those words to you, Marty, I feel discomfited. I'm like, oh, I don't like the idea of loosening that grip because I want to believe in the goodness of the world. But the benefit is that you have a more balanced reaction to the events that happen in your life and you don't overconclude from them. So there is some freedom to be found in untethering yourself from the belief in this sort of fairness.
Well, it sounds like you also got a lot of support when you told your story on your own podcast about the struggles you were having with having a baby. And somehow, I think when we do share our stories, people react mostly very generously react to our stories when they feel honest and real.
It's in the top most beautiful moments of my life. The reaction that I had to sharing our experience of the pregnancy losses and processing out loud what I was going through in the aftermath. I think I wrote in the book that it felt like I was being hugged by the world mm-hmm. all at once. And I was so moved by the kindness and the solidarity and the warmth and the outpouring of support and love, and also the confessionals of people going through their own slight changes of plan. I was so sheepish about sharing my story, Marty. You know, again, I'm used to being on this side of the mic or not the side that you're on.
Yeah.
Where I just hear about other people's stories. But then when this happened, I remember calling my producer and saying, I want to share the story, but it has to be tomorrow morning because I don't want to build a narrative around it or tell too clean a version of what I'm going through. I want people to hear the rawness of my pain right now because I think that's going to be the most helpful to people, that unfiltered, unvarnished version of what it means to experience this kind of heartbreak. And I basically said, publish this before I have a chance to change my mind.
Right.
And I just wasn't prepared for, you know, I had put out the episode with the hope of helping people. And I never could have imagined how much it would heal me in turn to do so. It was just such a life-giving humanity, faith in humanity restoring experience for me.
Well, and I wonder too, speaking of stories, whether fiction or movies or even TV shows, whether they offer us, you know, a different way to think about our lives. We try on, you know, different personas. You know, would I be that kind of heroine or that kind of hero? I'm thinking of the Odyssey, of course, you know, going through life. But it's a chance to try on something and see how it fits.
Yes. This was one of my favorite insights to discover when I was researching, because it turns out that fiction can be an identity laboratory. What that means is when you're reading about other characters, it turns out the mind effortlessly blends your own self-identity with the character's identity. And that creates this rich, fertile ground for you to take risks, make decisions you wouldn't have made otherwise, try on different identities for size, for fit. And I love that because we so rarely get these experimental playgrounds as adults, right? When you're kids, you can try on lots of things. No one's judging you. You're not sending it through any kind of filter. So I love the idea that something as fun as reading fiction can actually help us generate these new possible selves for our futures and to allow us to just play around a little bit, you know, and see whether there are facets of our personalities that may not have been unlocked.
Well, we have to leave it there. Maya Shunker, thank you very much for joining us today on The Connection.
Thank you for having me, Marty. Your questions were so, so thoughtful.
Well,
I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Maya Shunker's book is The Other Side of Change, Who We Become When Life Makes Other Plans. She's a cognitive scientist. The Connection airs every Friday and Sunday at noon right here on WHYY. You can listen to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. You can sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up on the show. Also, check us out on Instagram and Facebook. Also, send us an email with topic suggestions. We always want to know what you want to know. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of the show. It's produced by Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen.